This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, January 26, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Iti Agnihotri Madholkar. In a moment on Ozarks, $100,000 for one Fayetteville school. And later, Jeannie Wayne talks to Kyle about her new book, Delta Empire, about one of the most powerful business and political figures in Northeast Arkansas in the late 18th and early 19th centuries.
Ozarks at Large and KUAF, supported by listener contributions and by Malco Theaters, offering avoidance of sold-out movies and waiting in line with online ticket sales. Advance tickets to neighborhood Malco Theaters available online at malco.com.
But first, an elementary school in Fayetteville held a raucous celebration yesterday afternoon, and for good reason. The school learned it had been awarded $100,000 to use at its as it wishes. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda was there and has this report.
Yesterday, a handful of Asbell Elementary students stood on stage inside the Fayetteville School's auditorium holding numbered placards. LaTanya Green, the school's principal, used the demonstration as a way to announce to students, faculty, and guests that Asbell Elementary was the recipient of $100,000 from Target. Green received news Monday that Asbell was one of 50 schools to be awarded one of these grants.
Our reaction was disbelief. Of course, if someone calls you and says that you've won $100,000, you tend not to believe that if you haven't seen it in writing or if you knew you didn't nominate. And, you know, there's so much spam that comes through with people saying you're a billionaire over in some other country, just send us this information. And so it was really disbelief. I really asked her several times after even I hung up with her. She was supposed to email to me for information, but the information wasn't coming through because she was spelling my name wrong. But on my end, I felt like it really wasn't real because I couldn't get that information in writing. I couldn't get that in writing with someone over the phone. And so I had called her back several times. Finally, we figured out, called the district. They figured out that it was going into spam because she was spelling my name wrong. So we got that corrected. I got it in my hand. I talked to Mrs. Anderson, who confirmed that she was the one that nominated us. And so then we knew it was real. And so it's been great excitement since. I couldn't sleep last night. I could not sleep last night.
The award is part of $5 million Target is giving to schools to purchase much-needed resources and improve their learning environments. Asbell was the only school in Arkansas to receive the grant, and according to Fayetteville Public School officials, it has one of the highest rates of free and reduced lunches in the district. Schools had to be nominated for the grant, and the woman responsible for this nomination was Beth Anderson, whose 8-year-old son attends the school. She received news of the grant when she received a call from Principal Green.
And she said, Mrs. Anderson? And I said, yes. And she goes, this is Mrs. Green at Asbell. And I thought, oh, what did Hunter do? And she goes, I think I need to thank you. Is there something you nominated us for? And I said, yeah, a while back, it was an Ellen DeGeneres thing I did online, something with Target. And said, a grant of some sort? And she goes, you did, because we won. And she started screaming. They put me on speaker. Everybody was screaming. It was amazing. And I'm sitting in a little quiet office up on campus. And so it was quite a day yesterday.
According to a press release, the $5 million donation is part of Target's commitment to education, which includes plans to give $1 billion for education by the end of 2015. In early winter, viewers of the Ellen DeGeneres Show were invited to submit the name of a school in need, along with an explanation of why they felt their school should receive a grant. Target selected 48 schools and 2 school districts, and all recipients were chosen based on a number of factors.
I just basically explained, I came up here to volunteer for a class that I have in college, and looked out the back window, and there was new construction going on. And I said, oh, is that something new for Asbell? And they said, no, that's the high school. They're building tennis courts. And I thought, tennis courts in your backyard? Doesn't make sense. High school's on the other side of town. So I thought, why can't anything good happen for Asbell? And when I saw the nomination, I thought, we'll just try it, see what happens. I had no idea it would actually happen. And then when it did, I was so excited for Mrs. Green. It's just a really good thing for Asbel.
To announce and celebrate being awarded the grant, faculty helped spice up the children's daily afternoon assembly. Students were able to dance to the DJ Khaled song, All I Do Is Win, dance the Cupid Shuffle, and sing the school song. Principal LaTanya Green says she had a great group of people who helped her put the event together.
You know, I kept thinking about all the press conferences that you see, and I just kept thinking, that's not us. That's not our personality. That's not who we are. That's not who I am. And so we decided to be us. We decided to be who we are. Every day we have an assembly. We start our school with an assembly, with an assembly similar to that every single day. We sing happy birthday to everybody. We do our school announcements. We sing the school song. We recognize any great achievements by anybody, and that's, we start our day together every day, and we end our day together as well. And so what better way than to be ourselves?
Although it hasn't been long since the initial announcement, Green says they have started considering how to best use the grant.
Some of the ideas have been iPods for the teachers, smart boards, iPads for the teachers, smart boards. Kids, the kindergarten kids, like I said, wanted balloons and a cake and decoration. Kids want a playground. One of the big things that we've been talking about for a long time is a covered walkway from the gym to the school. Like this morning, it rained, and so when the kids go to PE, they get wet every day. It rains, they get wet. They get wet going, they get wet coming. And so that's one of our big priorities. Whatever we do, I don't know what, we haven't made a decision yet, but whatever we do, it's going to be something that affects all kids, not just a few kids, not just a few classrooms, but it's going to affect the whole entire school. And those are the things that we're going to choose. We're going to possibly upgrade our technology. Surely we've got to get the kids a playground. They've been trying to raise money for years to get a playground, and we've added some pieces. We had one torn down. It was so old, it was wooden. And so I know we're going to get a new playground. And so there's just lots of things, books for the book room, technology, playground, recess equipment, covered walkway. Those are the things top on my priority list.
She says it's just a matter of deciding, but that decision won't be made until she sees undeniable proof that her school has won the grant.
I need the check in my hand. Until I get the check in my hand, we're not going to make any decisions, any final decisions. But whatever we do, it won't be my decision. It'll be a group decision. And so, and like I said, it will affect all kids. All kids that go to Asbel need to know that when they walk under the covered walkway, when they play on the playground, or when they're doing something in the classroom with technology, they need to know that they got a piece of it, and it belongs to all of us. So that's not mine. It's not my son. Even my son said, don't you get half of that? And I said, son, I will go to jail if I take half of that. No, I don't get any of that. And so it will go to kids in our school.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me on the phone from Fort Smith is Michael Tilley. He is the editor and publisher, president of thecitywire.com. And Michael, I'm going to assume that maybe you have a new haircut. The reason I ask is the City Wire, as of a couple mornings ago, has a brand new look. So I thought maybe you did, too.
No, of course, my wife probably wishes I would get my hair cut and shave the beard, but no, I'm still the same old fat boy from Johnson County. But yes, the City Wire has a brand new look. Not only a new look, but a much more broad platform. We are now, with the look, focused also on providing content, providing news, business, political information, cultural information on the Northwest Arkansas region also. Our instincts were that people in the Fort Smith area and the Northwest Arkansas area are also interested in what goes on in the other region. That was our instinct, and so far that's proven to be true.
Well, I'm very interested in something that happened with the Sebastian County Quorum Court Tuesday night when it was a 7-6 vote deciding to not move forward on an aquatics facility that I thought was kind of flowing nicely.
Well, no pun intended. A lot of us that were watching thought that was going to go, but apparently members of the quorum court, several members of the quorum court feel that they haven't been, that the issue hasn't been properly vetted. They want to know more information. They were concerned about who would own the property. They were concerned about there were some that were concerned that the county lawyer hadn't reviewed the document that was written by the city's attorney. Now, Ray Gossick with the city of Fort Smith has come back and said, look, we've answered all these at several joint study sessions over the past 2 years. Kyle, this is just one. It just completely came out of left field. It'll be interesting to see. They may have a special meeting later next week or later this week even. It'll be interesting to see how that vote goes down. But, you know, our March 13th election has that issue on the ballot. So if the county decides not to support it, that ballot, that particular ballot item may be moved.
But as of now, this is not necessarily a permanent rejection as much as perhaps a potential hold?
Well, that's the question. You know, is it? Well, the first thing it does, or it gives ammunition to the folks that are against maybe spending tax dollars on an aquatics park. They're going to say, look, these guys have had concerns with it, and you should too. But, you know, it depends on how quickly the quorum court moves to approve it. It'll be interesting to see what else is said, but it appears that just, you know, as a journalist looking at it, it appears that County Judge David Hudson didn't have all the votes and hadn't communicated properly with all the members of his quorum court before they pushed this forward.
That was Tuesday night. Earlier on Tuesday, the Arkansas jobless rates for December were released for a fourth straight month. It did not go up, and for a third straight month, it went down. And in fact, since September, now a little bit more than dropped half a point, now 7.7%.
Right. If you're looking for good economic news, December brought some with the rate. However, we're still, I believe, about 34th consecutive month that our employment rate, our jobless rate in the state, has been above 7%. Now, Arkansas was one of about 46 states, or one of 46 states, to post an unemployment rate decrease in December. And what's interesting, if you look back 2 years, in December 2009, the unemployment rate was 7.9%, and in December 2010, it was 7.9%. Of course, this month, it was 7.7%. So, and that ties somewhat into the economic forecast event that was held there in Northwest Arkansas yesterday, where they talked about things improving in Arkansas and around the nation, but just continuing at this very slow pace in terms of economics, economic reports improving.
Yeah, the takeaway there was it's not great, but it doesn't look like it's going to get horribly worse.
Right, and then, you know, and they talked again about this threat of a double dip recession becomes less and less each month. So let's hope so. I mean, the one sector though in Arkansas, Kyle, that's still just reeling is the manufacturing sector. Employment was up to about 155,000 in December, which is just up 200 jobs from November. But, you know, it's still, that number is still more than 34% lower than it was in January 2001 when we began the previous decade. And we're down to manufacturing levels that the state had in early 1968.
Hmm. The governor was in our region yesterday. He talked to a gathering of aerospace interests in Fort Smith. He also was at Sparks Regional to look at telemedicine for stroke victims' opportunities, and also discussed a little bit about the severance tax.
Correct. He has said, Sheffield Nelson, who's a former energy industry guy, he's run for governor before unsuccessfully. He is pushing a ballot initiative that would raise Arkansas severance tax from 5% to 7%. It would also eliminate some of the what he calls loopholes in Arkansas severance tax law, but it's some rules that allow drillers to recover. It minimizes their risk in terms of how much they pay out on the rig in their first months of drilling. But Beebe is now, he has said in the past that he probably wouldn't actively campaign for it, but he'd probably go vote for it. But he's now reevaluating that, he said, because of this, what's called the Brown Dense Formation in southern Arkansas, which is it's where, you know, a lot of people forget, but they used to drill a lot of oil, gather a lot of oil in south Arkansas in this geologic formation. And so half of that formation is in Louisiana, half is in Arkansas, and Beebe says that he's concerned that if we boost our severance tax rate, that'll put us in a competitive disadvantage with Louisiana, and the drilling for the oil and the natural gas in that play would shift to Louisiana instead of being Arkansas. Well, that's his concern. That's why he's taking a second look now at this proposed severance tax initiative.
What might that mean for the severance tax success at the ballot?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, the industry proponents can argue that, you know, we just raised the tax in 2008. Let's not kill the industry. Natural gas prices that are still at historic lows. So the margins are virtually nil for some of these folks. The other thing, you know, that the governor, if he wants to actively campaign against it, I mean, he could say, for example, Southwestern Energy said they're going to spend around $240 million on what they call their new ventures efforts. And some of that includes drilling in this smackover brown dense formation in southern Arkansas. So it raises questions. I mean, Beebe has remained popular, even as a Democrat in Arkansas, he's remained very popular, and I still think he has some coattails that could help or hurt the cause.
Michael Tilley is the editor and publisher of thecitywire.com that covers politics, business, and more for the Fort Smith region. Michael, thank you.
Hey, thanks for talking to us, Kyle.
It's Thursday, the 26th of January, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Ithi Agnihotri Madhokar.
And I'm Kyle Kellums.
With us is Becca Bacon-Martin, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspaper.
We're confused all the time. And we have a good time with it, so it's okay. So, you need to go to Harrison tonight. That's the short of it.
About what, 2 hours from here?
Yeah.
From where we sit?
And if you can be there by 5:30 at the Boone County Library, you can hear Songs and Music of Robert Burns by the Crooked Creek Cayley Band. Mm-hmm. This is going to be a lot of fun.
It's free. Sorry. I see the spelling of C-E.
That's Cayley. C-E-I-L-I-D-H. And it's a Celtic word for party.
Okay. Why couldn't people just use party?
Well, because it's not Gaelic.
It's not Gaelic. That was Ithi just sinking down behind her microphone. We'll go on to a band called Carrie Nation and the Speakeasy.
That's a great name.
Okay.
From Kansas, oddly enough. Named after. Do you know who Carrie Nation is?
No, I know who Carrie Bradshaw is.
Carrie Nation
could not
count.
Be further apart. Carrie Nation was an abolitionist. Not an abolitionist, but a prohibitionist who lived for a bit in Eureka Springs.
Mm-hmm. And there's a Carrie Nation house in Eureka Springs. The band has nothing to do with prohibition, I'm pretty sure. They mix bluegrass and brass instruments for a sound they say blends punk, bluegrass, Dixieland, and circus tunes.
And where will they be?
10 o'clock tonight at, I'm turning the piece of paper, Smoke and Barrel Tavern in Fayetteville.
Starting at 10.
She can go.
All right. Tell me how it is.
Okay.
Becca Bacon-Martin is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. The land that is now Mississippi County, Arkansas, has had its share of trauma. Evidence shows the region experienced a centuries-long drought before Hernando de Soto arrived, and the massive New Madrid earthquake in the early 19th century further affected the area. The past 200 years have also presented difficulties, from yellow fever and malaria outbreaks to the Civil War and Reconstruction to the Great Depression. Mississippi County is the setting for the new book, Delta Empire, by Jeannie Wayne, a professor of history at the University of Arkansas. The book examines the life and career of Lee Wilson, a man who extended influence in Northeast Arkansas through his interest in agriculture, banking, railroading, and other business ventures. The author will discuss her book Saturday afternoon at Nightbird Books in Fayetteville. Yesterday, she came to KUAF.
One of the handicaps of a swampy terrain like that is not simply the disease, which is awful, but just the whole endeavor to try to get around. There's one quote I use about a political campaign in the early 20th century where one of the candidates would wear two pair of pants, and it probably wasn't all that uncommon. You wore to get around, mm-hmm. you to ride your horse, and you rode a horse more often than a buggy because there were too many of the roads that were impassable by buggy during certain times of the year. So he would wear one pair of pants over his dress pants, and when he got to his campaign stop, he would take off the muddy pair of pants and be ready to rock and roll, or at that point in time, I guess it wasn't rock and roll, but ready to give his speech.
If the land was tough, Mr. Wilson's first 20 years of his life were tough as well.
Yes.
I mean, this area and he seem to have a lot in common in that respect.
Yes, I'm glad you raised that because I came to my understanding of Lee Wilson first from what I was reading about him 25, 30 years ago, secondary literature that was based on him as a more mature planter. And in writing this book, I had to find out much more about his early life. And there were a number of real surprises there. I remember the day I found out what I reckon to be the key for me in understanding his single-minded determination to acquire and maintain control of land and people. And that was the day I was in the Shelby County Courthouse in Memphis, Tennessee, just as an offhand chance that there might be something there because I knew his father had died there. And I asked the man at the desk if there was anything on Josiah Wilson, Lee Wilson's father. And he brought back a thick folder of probate records from Josiah's death. He died without a will, an unwise thing in all cases, but in his case, particularly unwise because he had two families, children by a first marriage and children by a second marriage, and a surviving wife by the second marriage. And the oldest daughter and her husband, by the first marriage, challenged Lee Wilson and his brother's right to inherit on the basis that he was illegitimate. Now, this older sister and her husband, keeping in mind that in the mid-19th century, 19th century, women, married women, did not have much standing in court. So it was her husband, Napoleon Lafont, who was actually carrying on this litigation. They lose at this because, according to Arkansas law, if a man marries a woman with whom he has had children and acknowledges those children to be his own, they're made legitimate by that marriage. Nevertheless, they had raised the challenge, and then later on, after Lee Wilson's mother dies in the 1878 yellow fever epidemic in Memphis, and he's left literally an orphan at age 13, this brother-in-law assumes partial control over Lee Wilson's property. This puts Lee Wilson under the power of the very person that tried to disinherit him. And he's a child. He's 13 years old. Those moments in his life, the loss of his father, the loss of his mother, the challenge to his right to inherit, really brought into focus for me at that point in time what motivated Lee Wilson. He had fundamental challenges to his survival, essentially, very early in life. It had to have been formative.
And lost siblings
he
very early.
He lost siblings, and that's the other factor. He had, counting own siblings, full siblings and half siblings, he had four. By the time he is 20, he has one left, and that is the sister who is deaf, and as they said, called it then, dumb, who was deaf, and thus handicapped, particularly in the 19th century. This would leave you very vulnerable when there weren't many who understood what the issues were with regard to deaf people. She is also female, which under law makes her particularly vulnerable. So he's the only one left, except for this sibling who he takes responsibility for and handles her estate quite ably, I might add. The other key for me was watching the way he dealt with his responsibility toward his sibling and toward the children of his sister Victoria. And that was very responsibly. While he was almost ruthless in his acquisition of land and property, he was assiduously and rigorously honest he was honest in his dealings with his responsibilities. He made sure that their interests were pursued adequately.
As you would suspect, a powerful businessman in the time frame we're talking about had a complicated relationship with African Americans, freedmen.
Yes.
For example, the school that he created for children of African Americans, the
Wilson Industrial School.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, on one hand, you could say, well, he does come across as someone who has a sort of social obligation that there needs to be education. On the other hand, they're only educated to learn things that can eventually help him.
Yes.
Or fellow planters.
Yes.
And one of the reasons the school is there, because he does not want African-American laborers to leave. He understands how much he relies on them.
Yes.
So it's coached maybe in social good, but there's a lot of personal benefit there.
Right. Maybe that's always the case with such things.
Sure.
But I think it's very clear with him that it serves his interests. Nevertheless, others could have done that and did not do it.
Right.
So, I mean, I think it says something altogether. The other thing, I hope it's clear in the chapter that I wanted to make, the other point that I wanted to make in talking about that was the building of the industrial school happens in 1924. That's just three years after the lynching of an African American, not on his plantation, but next to his plantation. A complicated story, but let me just summarize it by saying Lowry worked for Lee Wilson's brother-in-law. Lowry was a very capable, able, well-respected within the black community African-American man who did not like the settlement he got at the end of the year in 1920 from the Craig family and demanded a written release so that he could leave the plantation. Dick Craig, who was running the plantation at the time, refused to give it to him and apparently hit him. So a few weeks after that occurred, Lowry went to the Craig family home.
Christmas Day.
And demanded his written settlement again. Shots were fired. Who fired first, we'll never know. But in the end, Lowry shot and killed Oscar Craig, Dick Craig's father, who was 70 years old, and Maybelle Craig, who was Oscar's daughter and Dick's sister. And he wounded Dick Craig and his brother. Lowry himself was wounded but escaped, was hidden in the swamps by a group of African-American men from his Odd Fellows Lodge. That's not an incidental fact, that respectable African-American men would hide a killer, as he was accused of being, and obviously had killed him. No one disputes that. Suggests that this is a very complicated situation. Mm-hmm. If you're a respectable African American man or of any race,
that can lose everything
by doing this, do you do it lightly? Do you take it lightly? And I say no. So I think that says something about the situation, about these Odd Fellows members' perception of the situation and understanding of the situation and about Lowry himself. So anyway, Lowry escapes, makes it to El Paso, tries to get a letter home to his wife and children. The letter is intercepted. The letter lays out what his alias is, where he's working. Arkansas authorities are alerted to the fact that where he is, and they alert El Paso officials, and the El Paso officials go to the bank where Lowry is firing a furnace and arrest him. And Lowry says, when he's arrested, kill me now because they'll burn me sure. He is returned to Arkansas and burned at the stake. And the descriptions of that burning are just excruciating. So that happened. That whole event happened just a couple, two or three years ahead of the time of the building of the school. And one pertinent fact: Lee Wilson was brother-in-law to Oscar Craig. So this is his family. Remember Lee Wilson's fidelity to family. So what I'm saying is, the building of that schoolhouse 3 years later has to be understood in terms of the Lowry lynching. What Lee Wilson was doing was not only building an edifice that would attract labor and keep labor there for the sake of keeping labor there, but in a sense saying thank you for not running away, thank you for not leaving when Lowry was burned at the stake. Now, this is related to the Elaine Race riot that occurred just a year before, year and a couple of months before the Lowry lynching, where African Americans were hunted down and shot and killed in Elaine, Arkansas, around Elaine, Arkansas, in Phillips County. After that event, African Americans left Phillips County in droves. And what Lee Wilson and other planters were concerned about after the Lowry lynching was a similar exodus of African American labor. They do everything they can to keep labor from leaving. They have a huge meeting not many months after the Lowry lynching, professing how wonderful conditions are in Mississippi County and how awful conditions are elsewhere, and you better stay here.
Especially up north. Don't go to Missouri.
Don't go to Missouri. Don't go north, because things are terrible there. So I think this is all by way of saying that burning, that building of the schoolhouse was symbolic of a lot of things. It's a very complicated story. I hope I make it clear in the book. Now, of course, I'm sure you're about to point out that the schoolhouse itself was burned to the ground on the day it was to, on the early morning hours of the day it was to be dedicated. At which point, Lee Wilson vows to rebuild it. And he says, only I will build it of brick and hollow tile, so they can't burn it this time. And he does rebuild it. He does rebuild it just a year later, of brick, I suppose, and hollow tile. Now, the other aspect of this building is that I don't have the paperwork on this, can't prove it, but I'm almost certain, because of his operating procedure, that he undoubtedly had mortgaged that building and had insured that building. So then when it was burned to the ground, he got insurance money for it and then rebuilt it. And you can bet your bottom dollar that he mortgaged it again, because everything he had was mortgaged.
And that's not to suggest it was a scam.
No.
It was just that he covered bases.
He covered. He was very careful about that. So
when you write about the episode with Lowry and who is eventually lynched, it seems you have to have a deft hand, because as a historian, you can only deal with the facts that are available.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a hefty subject.
Mm-hmm.
And the responsibility you have.
Dealing with Lee Wilson and race relations was always the most troubling aspect of the Lee Wilson story. And as a matter of fact, in some ways, the most interesting. Perhaps those two are connected.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to figure that out. You can't help. They say about biographers that you either love them or hate them, the subject of your biography, by the end. I'd say my reaction to Lee Wilson is much more complicated by that.
Good, because mine as a reader was.
Yes. I have to say, and it made me reluctant to even take on the story, was I didn't think I liked Lee Wilson. Because of his problematic relationship with black labor. I mean, just as a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And historians are human beings. I mean,
mm-hmm.
we can't help but have points of view, as much as we might strive to rise above them in our writing of things. And things began to change again after that moment in at the Shelby County Courthouse, when I found out the sort of travails that Lee Wilson as a child went through and came to understand his single-mindedness and even ruthlessness from that point of view. I wasn't letting him off the hook, but I said, okay, I get this now. I understand what motivates him. At the same time, his relationship with black labor was was sincere. I think he did have a sense of commitment. It was what a historian, C. Van Woodward, would call the conservative position on race. He believed that African Americans were inferior, but he thought they ought to be treated fairly and ought not to be violently repressed. That's not to say that he didn't himself exploit them like he did all labor in terms of white and black labor in terms of mortgaging them to the hilt and making sure that they remained indebted to him as one means of keeping them in place.
And also in here, we don't have time, but the story about the Osceola Times and how newspapers would refer to the spring fights and the fall fights because it's a rough and tumble time and when young single men would just beat each other up.
I loved that. I actually spent it's inconceivable to me now that I spent as much time on this, but I sat down with the Osceola Times and went through it. Every issue from – it's a weekly, thank goodness – every issue from the early 1880s to 1900. And then after that, I sort of just checked a few issues. But it took me 3 months. And I copiously took notes, and I entered it in an Excel program, and I did statistical analysis. Whatever possessed me to do that, I do not know. But in the meantime, I ran across some remarkable stories about disease. I could do some numbers on disease and how it was affected over time. But also these fabulous stories about these young unmarried men who got into all sorts of trouble over often alcohol-related, over gambling, over women, or just for the heck of it, would get into fights. And one included.
And this isn't stage. This isn't boxing. This is just going down to somebody's right.
Right. You know, it could happen in a bar room. It could happen on a street corner. In fact, one of my favorite stories involved Leon Roussan, who is a great unsung hero of Arkansas history in my mind. And he was the editor of the Osceola Times. Mm-hmm. He had opposed disfranchisement. He had of African Americans, and he was also a temperance man, very respectable, very prudent, very good person. He was himself assaulted on the streets by a young of Osceola by a young man who was angry about something said about him in a story in the Osceola Times, Leon Roussan's newspaper, and punched Leon Roussan, and Leon struck back. And so he got – he himself, this temperate man, was involved in a fight, which became a great joke among his friends.
The name of the book is Delta Empire. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Jeannie Wayne is the author of the new book, Delta Empire, Lee Wilson and the Transformation of Agriculture in the New South. She'll discuss the book and sign copies of the book Saturday afternoon at 4 at Nightbird Books in Fayetteville. It is the 26th of January, a Thursday. That means Jody Beznoska, Vice President of Communications of Walton Arts Center, is with me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio on what at least has started out as kind of a rainy, dreary Thursday.
Yeah. Hopefully it will clear up.
It's supposed to.
Yeah. Could never live in Seattle.
No. Although I will tell you that I've probably been in Seattle like 8 or 9 days of my entire life, and I haven't seen a cloud yet there. So I think they might be just...
They just sort of make it up.
Mm-hmm,
keep everybody out.
Well, you don't want people to keep people out from Walton Arts Center.
No, definitely not. We've got a really, really busy month coming up. It starts on this coming Saturday with Lewis Black, the comedian. That is an 8 o'clock show. As we've been mentioning for the past few weeks, that show doesn't have any tickets available right now. So what you need to do if you really want to see Lewis Black is come down to the Arts Center and get on the standby list. And if tickets, you know, come available at the last minute or if some tickets get turned back, we will try as hard as we can to get you in. Also want to give everybody a word of caution about scalpers. That's something we don't deal with very much here in the region, but for some of these shows that are sold out for a long time, it's generally a little bit dangerous if you buy tickets to a show that isn't that, that that is not at the Walton Arts Center website.
You might get a counterfeit ticket, or you might just not even ever get the ticket.
Either of those have happened. Mm. We're lucky in that that doesn't happen too much in this market. But when it comes to sold out shows, I know people are looking for secondary ticket sites, and you know, StubHub is usually okay. But if you're going beyond that, it's a little bit you're taking a chance, because a lot of these places will actually sell that same ticket two or three times.
Oh,
yeah, and so then you have this horrible situation.
Confusion.
Where people show up and three people have tickets for the same seat. So the only place to get tickets for Walton Arts Center shows should be waltonartscenter.org.
Or your trusted neighbor who can't make it.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. But on a happier note, yes. Lewis Black, again, that's 8 p.m. on the 28th. That's the last show in January for us. And then we move into February. Next weekend is very busy at Walton Arts Center. And it starts on the 2nd of February. That's a Thursday. That morning, we will have two master classes with the Mark Morris Dance Group. And this is something that we do as much as we possibly can at Walton Arts Center. When we get a visiting company like the Mark Morris Group, they love to teach. Mm-hmm. And they love to get out into the community and work with people in the dance world. So they're offering two different master classes. They both are at the same time. One is at 11 a.m., and it's at the university in the Hyper Building. And that is for dancers, people with dance experience, probably at least 1 or 2 years of dance experience. And that's you can get tickets and reservations for that at our website. And then the other one that we have at 11 o'clock, which I just think is so fascinating, Mark Morris Dance Company likes to do outreach and likes to work with the Parkinson's community. So they're going to be doing a masterclass in Star Theater at Walton Arts Center for people with Parkinson's.
Amazing.
Which is just such a great thing. It basically gets into how movement can help you manage the symptoms of that disease. And that is, I love it when I hear about dance companies that cross over like that. That is an 11 o'clock masterclass. You can't register for that at Walton Arts Center. You need to call 646-450-3373 to do that. And that's before they even do their show.
Right.
Then they will have a performance at 7 p.m. that evening. That's Thursday evening the 2nd. There will be a 6 p.m. creative conversation prior to the show. Creative conversation is free and open to anyone. I believe it's in, I think it's in Star Theater, or it could be on stage, one or the other. And then the show is at 7, and the tickets for this are only $10.
Part of the 10x10 series, yeah.
10x10 art series. So that's just Thursday night. Then on Friday night.
Now, this is all next week.
Next weekend.
Not this weekend,
correct.
But next weekend.
Next weekend. Friday the 3rd, we will have the Time for Three musical group. That's an 8 p.m. performance with a 7 p.m. creative conversation. These guys are young, classically trained musicians who have crossed over into every musical genre you could imagine. They play bluegrass, country, pop, whatever. They play it all. And the story of how they came together is pretty interesting. They used to just jam together, and then two of them were playing with the Philadelphia Orchestra at the Mann Center about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, maybe longer, and the lights went out. And there was no music. They were supposed to be having a concert. So while the crew was trying to fix the lights, two of these guys from Time for Three got up on stage and did a jam session, and the crowd went crazy. And that was sort of the genesis of this new group. They're also going to be doing outreach. They're going to be going to the Bentonville High School and the Rogers High School and talking to literally hundreds of kids about their music and about, you know, how to continue to grow and stay strong with your music. So very excited about that. Their performance is the 3rd of February. That's a Friday, 8 o'clock performance.
10x10.
10x10, $10 tickets. Then we will move into Bring It On, the musical. Finally, it's almost here. That runs from February 7th through the 12th. 8 performances. This is a Broadway musical based on, loosely, the known movie Bring It On. It features real cheerleaders, including a Bentonville High School former cheerleader named Sheldon Tucker. And the stunts are to die for. They are just so exciting, and I think this is going to be a really good one. On the 9th, Theater Squared will begin their 3rd show of the season.
That's correct.
Tigers,
yes.
Be Still. And it will run through March 4th. So I'm sure we'll talk more about that.
And Tuesday night, I'll talk with several of the people involved in the production.
That's
at
right,
the Fayetteville
Public,
Library.
Right. That's right. On the 12th of February, I believe we will have another countdown conversation for the 10x10 art series at the library.
Yes.
It's a 2 p.m. free conversation. And I think the focus this time will be on taiko drumming.
Yes.
Yes, which will be fun. So that's on the 12th at the library, 2 p.m., free and open to the public. And then on the 16th, Loretta Lynn will be here at last.
Finally,
7 p.m. performance. There are still a few tickets left for that. So if you missed your chance to buy them, get them now. They're gonna definitely vanish quickly. And then on the 21st through the 26th, we will have Million Dollar Quartet in town. Cody Slaughter, who is from Harrison, Arkansas, he is an award-winning Elvis impersonator, and he is in his first theatrical performance with Million Dollar Quartet. And we're really delighted. He's going to be, I think it's going to be really neat for him to come back to Arkansas and to be performing for this community.
And we're going to hear from him on Ozarks at Large sometime next week.
Yes, it's really great. Million Dollar Quartet, I can't wait to see what this area of the country does with this show. I think they're going to love it. Mm-hmm. That's the 21st of February through the 26th. And then the last show in February, I believe, is Dow Art of the Drum, which is the also on our 10x10 art series. And this will feature those loud, wonderful, incredibly athletic performances of taiko drumming.
If you love percussion, this is like Nirvana.
Oh, it's fantastic. I mean, you sit there and you marvel at the sound, but you also marvel at the athleticism of the performers. I mean, they clearly are not just gently banging on a drum here. They're really skilled, very highly trained to do that work. So that will be on the 28th of February. That's a 7:30 show. That we should have a 6:30 creative conversation for that as well.
All right. Everything we've talked about.
Everything we talked about you can learn about on our website at waltonartcenter.org, or you can call us at the box office, 443-5600, or you can stop down and see us at the Art Center. And we're putting up a new exhibition in the gallery. So next week we'll have our opening the same night as Mark Morris.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Joey.
Thank you.
This is Ozarks at Large, and it's time for our question now.
And winner today will receive two tickets to tonight's Elizabeth Cook concert at George's Majestic Lounge. It starts at 9, so you'd have to come by here this afternoon and pick mm-hmm. them up, or have someone do that for you. And we'll throw in a couple of tickets from Malco Movie Theaters as well.
That's a pretty good prize.
Yeah, pretty good prize.
And the question is the one that I thought of.
Yes.
And it's about the solar storm that happened 2 or 3 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of led to some spectacular northern lights. Now, we do know that northern lights that are often seen and maybe around the Arctic Circle and regions a little bit closer
maybe
to that.
Canada, Iceland,
yes.
Finland.
Mm-hmm. They are called Aurora Borealis.
Right.
But they also have a lesser known the underdog sibling called Southern Lights.
The Southern Lights.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What are Southern Lights called? You know, what is the Aurora Borealis counterpart?
To the Southern Lights.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gosh, this is a good question. 800-522-5823. 800-522-KUAF. Good luck.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 26th of January, 2012. It's the birthday of the British playwright Christopher Hampton, born in Fayal in the Azores Archipelago, 1946. He went to Oxford, studied modern languages. He wrote a play, When Did You Last See My Mother?, which was performed at Oxford and made its way to the West End. And at the age of 20, Hampton was the youngest playwright ever to have a play produced on the West End. He continued to write plays. He wrote a comedy called The Philanthropist. Hampton said, I had a conversation with my agent after The Philanthropist. She said, you've got a choice. You can write the same play over and over for the next 30 years, and you'll probably get even better at it. Or you can decide to do something completely different every time. So I said, as a matter of fact, I have started writing a play about the extermination of the Brazilian Indians in the 1960s. And she said, well, that'll do it. He wrote the movie Dangerous Liaisons, also about 20 films that never got produced. He co-wrote the book and lyrics for the musical Sunset Boulevard. He adapted Chekhov's The Seagull for the stage, wrote the screenplay for the film Atonement, adapted from Ian McEwan's novel, and translated several plays by the French playwright Yasmina Reza, including Art and God of Carnage, Christopher Hampton, who said, asking a working writer what he thinks about critics is like asking a lamppost what it feels about dogs. It's the birthday of the songwriter Lucinda Williams, born in Lake Charles, Louisiana, 1953, who said, above all, the listener should be able to understand the poem or the song, not be forced to unravel a complicated, self-indulgent puzzle. Offer your art up to the whole world, not just an elite few. It's the birthday of the science fiction writer Philip Jose Farmer, born in North Terre Haute, Indiana, 1918, grew up in Peoria, was working at a steel mill there, when he wrote his story, The Lovers, about an oppressive 31st century North America in which there is no nudity and human sexuality is highly controlled. Up until then, sex was taboo in science fiction. Most science fiction editors assumed that their audience of adolescent boys would not respond well to it. But the story was published. He got an award for it, quit his job in the steel mill, became a full-time writer. Philip Jose Farmer, who said, imagination is like a muscle. I found out that the more I wrote, the bigger it got. Here's a poem for today by Brad Rieke entitled The Beautiful Sandwich. She could always make the most beautiful sandwich, laced Swiss cheese sliced crossways folded once, ham in rolls like sleeping bags, turkey piled like shirts, tarragon, oregano, pepper, herb dill mayonnaise the color of skin, on top the thin wandering line of mustard like a contour on a map in a thin flat drawer or a single lost vein, the poppy seeds hold on for now. Placed on the plate like isolated driftwood or a large, solemn head, the spilled chips in yellow piles are like the strange coins of tall, awkward islanders. The thin dill pickle, their boat, slides into the green, sour sea. The Beautiful Sandwich by Brad Rieke from American Mastodon, published by Black Lawrence Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. You can turn your iPhone or Android into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's poetry app, available to everyone online at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Kathy Roach and Nick Vetter. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time now to answer a pretty good question that you came up with.
Thank you. Thank you.
you mentioned that the solar storm had kind of meant there were northern lights viewings possible further south than usual.
Mm-hmm.
Northern lights called Aurora Borealis. You've just told me there are also southern lights.
There are. And the question was, what is the Aurora Borealis equivalent of southern lights? And any guesses?
It's obviously Aurora.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say it's Aurora Antarctica. I have no idea.
You're almost there.
Really? What is it?
Aurora Australis.
Oh. Well, we will hand out the tickets to the Elizabeth Cook concert tonight at George's Majestic Lounge at 9 o'clock, plus a couple of movie passes from Amalco Movie Theater.
And two more, just for your general knowledge, today is also Australia Day, or as the Aboriginals
yes.
like to call it, Invasion Day, and
yes.
also the Republic Day of India. I just had to mention that.
What do I say?
Happy Republic Day.
Happy Republic Day.
Thank you. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, Harrison.
County seat of Boone County. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Ithi Agnihotri-Matholkar.
And have a great Thursday. Traveling in a fighter combi on a hippie trailhead full of zombies. I met a strange lady, she made me nervous.